Hello, Sentence Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader, with stories from the very popular magazine True West. This periodical focuses on stories of the American West, and my readings will focus mainly on the events and characters that shaped our Arizona history and culture. Today I will focus on a couple of characters that were part of the Wyatt Earp story. First, the infamous Doc Holliday. We know him as Wyatt Earp's friend and participant in the famous gunfight at the OK Corral. The reading is from an article published in the True West magazine's issue, May-June 1962, authored by John Carson and cleverly titled Doc Holliday. It wasn't his background that made Doc Holliday what he was. He became what he was in spite of it. The mother of the notorious gunfighter was Ellis Jane McKee, a beautiful, refined South Carolinian from whom John Henry would inherit his blonde hair, his refinement, and on occasion his alias. He would become known in Cheyenne and Denver as Tom McKee long before his fame as Doc Holliday. Alice was born in 1829 and moved a few years later with her family to a farm near Griffin, Georgia. When she was 20, she married Henry Holliday, 9 years her senior, a well-educated Southerner with a straightforward manner and a violent temper. From him, Doc would inherit the manner and the temper. Henry Holliday served in the Mexican War as a commissioned officer with a volunteer infantry company from Georgia. After the war, he settled near Griffin and became, in a short time, mayor of the town and a man of considerable means. The first child born to Alice Jane and Henry was a little girl who died before she was a year old. It is not known exactly when John Henry was born, but it was probably during the winter of 1851-1852. He remained the only child. Like Clay Allison's of Tennessee, John Henry's boyhood was full of talk of secession, abolition, and Yankees. Georgia followed the lead of her sister states, seceded in 1861. Once again, Henry Holliday donned a uniform, this time as a captain in Confederate gray. He served gallantly but was discharged before the end of hostilities because his health was broken. At 43, he looked 60. His business had failed, but he still owned some property and was far from being poverty-stricken. His fortune at the time approximated $20,000. However, it was sifting away, and he decided to move to Valdosta, where he had other interests. Major Holliday, sick though he was, became a leading citizen of the growing town. A street was named for him. Here, John Henry received his education, or at least some of it. When he was about 15, his mother died. He had always been especially close to the gentle Alice, partly because of the continued absence of the major, but mostly because both he and his mother were usually on the defensive against the major's violent outbursts, made more frequent by his illness and the lost fortune. In 1867, the major remarried. Not much information has come down about John's stepmother, but it is certainly that she did not fill the vacancy left by the death of the beloved mother of the boy. John lived a good social life in Valdosta. Thin, about 5'10", blue-eyed and blonde, young Holliday gave no hint of the disease which would one day take his life. He studied dentistry in Baltimore and no doubt would have been completely successful in that profession had not two things combined to change his life: his naturally restless nature, and the onslaught of tuberculosis. In school, John had learned to play cards, to manipulate them, rather, because Doc never played cards in his life. Gambling was to become his profession, and he was destined to be as eminent in that as his father had hoped he would be in dentistry. He hung up his shingle in Atlanta, but his illness already had such a hold, he hardly knew a painless day. Finally, the young doctor turned his face to the west, first to New Orleans, then on to Texas. Although he tried to practice, more and more time was spent in the saloons. Soon, only liquor and more liquor could ease the pain. In later years, Wyder, one of the few friends Doc ever took trouble to make, told Stuart Lake that Holliday would polish off great quantities of whiskey before breakfast and was actually most dangerous when he was not drinking. In Dallas, he drank, he gambled, he pulled teeth. Gradually, the latter activity was eliminated altogether. Holliday became known as a sharp dealer. Many men and women who called him Doc would have been amazed to learn that the title was genuine. After a drunken shooting scrape in which, fortunately, no one was hurt, Doc left Dallas and went to Fort Griffin, then one of the hairiest towns in the Lone Star State. From this point, Doc's activities have been pretty well documented. His on-again, off-again romance with Kate Fisher, his almost fanatic attachment to the fighting Earps, particularly the quiet Wyatt, and the hell for leather Morgan. His offer to fight a handkerchief duel with handsome John Ringo. After the Earp crowd left Tombstone, Doc went his own way. It is said that Doc and Wyatt had words, true or not, it is certain they never saw each other again after they separated in Colorado. Doc's disease had so racked his body that he became absolutely unconcerned about his future. He wanted to die and would fight anyone or any group with fists, firearms, or blades. Finally, after a hard winter in Leadville, he went to Glenwood Springs, a resort where he hoped he would be helped. But no one can live anywhere without money, so he earned himself some. On one occasion, when the great builder of railroads, John Kiner, was trying to get some track construction done near Glenwood, he was bothered by saloons which had been established near his camp. His workers were spending more time in the saloons than they were on the job. Kiner tried to get rid of the whiskey peddlers, but they refused to quit their bonanza. Kiner was introduced to Doc, and the little gunman offered to get rid of the saloons for $250. Kiner paid him, and the saloons folded. In his excellent autobiography, End of Track, Kiner referred to him as Doc Halliday. Apparently, the Tombstone story had not spread through the West. That was probably Doc Halliday's last job. In 1887, the gunfighting dentist who had tried his damnedest to die standing up smiled wanly as he lay between his clean hospital sheets and said, "This is funny." A few minutes later, the man from Valdosta was dead. Next, we'll look at someone you may have heard of as Johnny Behind the Deuce. His real name was Mike O'Rourke. This article was published in the True West Magazine's issue of October 2015 and authored by Bob Bowes Bell, the publisher of the magazine. And the title is The Standoff. Before I present the articles, I want to point out that Wyatt Earp's encounter with Johnny Behind the Deuce is one of the incidents that the original book about Wyatt Earp describes to showcase Wyatt's great courage under pressure. History has indeed validated this characterization, but this particular incident was not as dramatic as the book describes. Here is the real story. Michael Rourke, 18, also known as Johnny Behind the Deuce, and his roommate Robert Petty, 23, are eating at Smith's Restaurant in Charleston, Arizona. It's lunchtime, and Tombstone Mill and Mining Company's chief engineer, Philip Schneider, 28, comes in and sits at the next table, joining A.E. Lindsay, a local telegraph operator. Having finished his meal, O'Rourke gets up and walks over near the fireplace, sits on a stool, and lights a cigar. "You look cold, Lindsay," Schneider says to his table mate. Lindsay admits he has about half a chill. O'Rourke says, "Yes, it is cold." "I ain't talking to you," says Schneider, who suspects the miner burglarized his cabin. O'Rourke mutters, "Well, you're a little too smart anyhow." The mining engineer threatens O'Rourke, who heads for the door, yelling, "I will lick you when you come out." Waiting outside, O'Rourke is armed with Petty's pistol, which he had retrieved from their room. He and Petty walk down near the corner of Frank Stillwell's corral, where he again meets with the telegraph operator. "I think that old fellow is crazy," says Lindsay, referring to Schneider. All three decide to retire to a saloon for a drink, but as they turn to go up the street, they encounter Schneider, speed walking towards them. He comes right up to O'Rourke and demands, "What the hell did you mean by talking to me in that way?" Petty tries to intervene, but Schneider pushes him away, snarling at O'Rourke and saying, "I see you've got a pistol, but you need not think that I'm afraid of it." O'Rourke holds out his left hand, warning Schneider to stay away from him, but Schneider keeps coming as he pulls out a clasp knife. Constable George McKelvey has been watching the encounter. When O'Rourke pulls the pistol, the lawman runs towards them, shouting, "Don't you shoot!" The pistol discharges. The bullet hits Schneider above the upper lip on the left side of the nose, killing him instantly. O'Rourke drops the weapon and runs towards the San Pedro River. Constable McKelvey races up, grabs O'Rourke's pistol, and demands that O'Rourke stop, but he keeps running. McKelvey's weapon misfires, so he fires O'Rourke's pistol successfully. Johnny behind the deuce stops immediately and is arrested. The fight is over, but the battle for the young gambler's life has just begun. With a gathering crowd looking for a rope to lynch the gambler, McKelvey loads the defendant into a buckboard and takes off for Tombstone. The enraged mob follows him to Tombstone. Virgil Earp shows up while out exercising his brother's Wyatt's thoroughbred horse, Dick Naylor. Taking in the scene at a glance, Virgil has O'Rourke jump up behind him and take off for Tombstone. Virgil and his prisoner arrive well ahead of the mob. Local law enforcement officers, led by Tombstone Marshal Ben Sippy, deposit the prisoner at Jim Vogan and Jim Flynn's saloon and Tenpin Bowling Alley, until they can procure a wagon to take him to Tucson. The Charleston mob is soon joined by miners from the Tombstone area, and they all, some 300 strong, descend on Tombstone's Allen Street, looking for the prisoner. Upon seeing the killer being guarded by some local gamblers, Doc Holliday, Wyatt Earp, and Charlie Smith, they jump to the conclusion that the gamblers are defending one of their own from justice. The crowd surges forward to confront the prisoner and his guards. The following description was reported in the January 17, 1881 edition of the Tombstone Epitaph. In a few minutes, Allen Street was jammed with an excited crowd, rapidly augmented by scores from all directions. By this time, Marshal Ben Sippy, realizing the situation at once, had secured a well-armed posse of over a score of men to prevent any attempt on the part of the crowd to lynch the prisoner. But feeling that no guard would be strong enough to resist a justly enraged public long, procured a light wagon in which the prisoner was placed, guarded by himself, Virgil Earp, and Deputy Sheriff John Behan, arrested by a strong posse well armed. Moving down the street, closely followed by the throng, a halt was made, and rifles leveled on the advancing citizens, several of whom were armed with rifles and shotguns. Marshal Sippy's sound judgment prevented any such outbreak, and cool as an iceberg, he held the crowd in check. Two books, Walter Noble Burns's Tombstone and Iliad of the Southwest, and Stuart Lake's Wyatt Earp Frontier Marshal, Wyatt Earp backs down the mob all by himself. Now this is at odds with the newspaper accounts which do not mention Wyatt's name. Tucson's Arizona Weekly Citizens gives credit to Deputy United States Marshal Virgil Earp and his companions. In 1928, however, Tombstone diarist George Parsons writes Lake that Wyatt displayed considerable nerve during the incident. Parsons writes, "Wyatt, I could see him now as his team went down the street. He backed his horse down the street fronting the mob and lowered his rifle every now and then on them when a rush was attempted." He adds, "It was a very nervy proposition, particularly on the part of Wyatt." Wyatt most likely did help his brother Virgil and City Marshal Ben Sippy hold back the mob, but in light of the known record, thinking Wyatt did so all by himself is preposterous. The story continues. A 15-man Arizona posse rode with Pima County Sheriff John Behan, Charleston Constable George McKelvey, and Tombstone Marshal Ben Sippy for 12 miles. Although the mob made threats to intercept the posse in Pontana by taking a shortcut, no action materialized. The prisoner was delivered without incident to the Tucson jail. On February 1, 1881, Justice Joseph Nugas ordered that Mike Rourke be held in county jail without bail to await trial for his murder charge. Before the next grand jury convened, O'Rourke escaped on April 18, 1881, while he and other prisoners were in the jail yard prior to the evening lockdown. The Tombstone epitaph speculated that for about 20 seconds the prisoners were out of the guard's sight. Of O'Rourke, the paper reported, "Someone threw him up so that he could grasp the top of the wall. No easy task, since the wall was a reported 16 feet high." The grand jury officially indicted O'Rourke on May 19th. The last sighting of O'Rourke was reported in the Tombstone epitaph on May 13th, 1881. "Johnny Behind the Deuce was seen 3 days ago, we are informed, in the Dragoon Mountains. He was well mounted and equipped, and was on the eve of departure for Texas. The climate of Arizona," he said, "did not agree with him." And so ends the story of Johnny Behind the Deuce. He was never seen again. Readers of True West Magazine can write in and ask questions of Arizona's official state historian, Marshall Trimble. Here are some questions and his informative responses. From the January 2020 issue of True West Magazine, someone writes, the Marshal, reader Chase Appleby of Venice, Florida, writes in the question, "What was the relationship between U.S. Marshals and town marshals or county sheriffs?" Marshal Trimble answers, "A deputy U.S. Marshal was responsible for federal crimes, and a town marshal or county sheriff had authority dealing with town or county crimes respectively. Many times, county or sheriffs or town marshals were also deputized as deputy U.S. marshals. Virgil Earp is a good example. He was a marshal of Tombstone and deputy U.S. marshal. But being a U.S. marshal was a full-time administrative job. A person in that position rarely makes arrests. So Gunsmoke's Matt Dillon being a U.S. marshal in Dodge City was bogus. The town marshal, county sheriff, and their deputies would have been responsible for the day-to-day job of upholding the law. And now Forrest Sutton of Austin, Texas writes in, did Old West prisoners have access to health care? Marshal Trumbull answers, health care in Old West prisons and jails varied widely. Most prisons had some kind of medical facility or infirmary to treat the sick, but actual medical care was limited. For example, the infirmary of the territorial prison at Yuma had 12 beds. Doctors were available sporadically, usually called in from the neighboring community, and few served longer than a year. A Dr. Cotter served from 1893 to 1896. During his tenure, he established the prison hospital. Adding to the problem, the jails/prisons were filthy and full of germs, so sickness was rampant. Next question is submitted to Marshal Trumbull by reader Rick Clark of Colorado Springs, Colorado. He asks, did the Indians really whoop and holler during battles? Attacking warriors from most tribes did use yells and screams to terrify and discombobulate their foes. Apaches were experts at terrifying their prey, running behind rocks and cover to unleash screams and arrows. It wasn't just American Indians who used that strategy. It's just about all cultures used battle cries. It's pretty universal then and now. A good example is the rebel yell used by Confederates during the Civil War. The next question is posted by Lewis McMullen of Henderson, Tennessee. The reader writes Marshal Trumbull the following question. In The Searchers, John Wayne is seen wearing a straw hat. Is that authentic? Marshal Trumbull says, straw hats were quite common in the Southwest. Soldiers, Indians, settlers, farmers, and cowboys all wore them. Soldiers could buy them at the settler's store for around 50 cents. Felt hats were more popular in the cooler months, but when the weather heated up, they switched to straws. The big drawback, straw hats didn't hold up in the rain or snow. Reader Paul Gortez of Phoenix, Arizona writes Marshal Trumbull and asks, who was Lew Cooley? Marshal Trumbull says Cooley played a major role in the wider Vendetta Ride. He worked as a stage driver in Tombstone and had friends in Wells Fargo management. He also acted as a special agent in April 1882 when Wyatt Earp was staying at the Henry Clay Hooker's Sierra Bonita Ranch. Cooley brought him $1,000 of expense money provided by Wells Fargo General Superintendent John Valentine. Cochise County Sheriff John Behan learned of the plan and arrested Cooley, charging him with aiding Wyatt. Judge Wells Spicer dismissed the case, calling the charges frivolous. The next question to Marshal Trumbull is from Bob Powers of Cincinnati, Ohio. Bob writes in, an article in the July 2019 issue of True West says, the photographer of the authenticated Billy the Kid tintype is unknown. Yet it also claims that he left his thumbprints on the ferrotype while developing. Could he not be traced by those? The U.S. courts first began accepting fingerprints in 1911, although some identification was done in the 1890s. The tintypist could not be traced unless there was a record of his prints, which is unlikely. I ran this by Dan Buck, an expert on the subject of fingerprints, and he replied, "Well, yes, if the tintypist was arrested and printed by the FBI in 1930, then maybe." We've reached the end of our visit to the Old West and hearing stories about the heroes and villains, lawbreakers and law enforcers, movers and shakers. I hope you enjoyed flipping through the pages of True West magazine with me, Michael Shannon, your St. Sounds volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.